Welcome to the Anarcho Book Club. This week we're going to be talking about Debt, The First 5,000 Years by David Graeber. And I told you guys before that I really wanted to cover one of his books, especially in the light of his recent and unfortunate death. So I chose Debt. I had read it before. It was published in 2011. I had read it before, but never really grasped it. And as I'm reading through it again, I'm really starting to grasp the theories and the ideas that he has behind it. And I'm just going to go through about a third of it in this episode. I think we'll try to tackle the rest of it in the next episode, so bear with me. So we'll just go through with a little outline of the different sections. And this really seems like a collection of essays, but sort of adapted or modified to fit into a book form. So he doesn't have chapter title or chapter numbers, but each section is has its own focus. The first, the chapter or the sections we're going to go through today, they're called On the Experience of Moral Confusion, The Myth of Barter, and then there's a section with some subsections, Primordial Debts. Subsection of that is State and Credit Theories of Money, In Search of a Myth, and then the next section is Cruelty and Redemption. So we're going to go through these and kind of, I'll just give you my thoughts on what I've found through all of them so far. On the first section, it's more of an introduction to the whole concept of debt and money. He explains, he opens the whole book with an example. And you'll notice as you go through this book, tons of examples. They'll introduce topics, they'll help to explain topics. He does a really good job of communicating his ideas through example. And not only that, though, there are parts of the book that you'll find he communicates his ideas and his discoveries, I think, more than ideas. It's not that he came up with these on his own, so to speak. He discovered these different ideas of debt and barter and money. In this first one, he talks about being at a garden party at Westminster Abbey, and he opens the book with this, and how he has this conversation with a lady who's an activist for anti-poverty groups in London. And they get, as many discussions do, they get down to the root, and that is, for this specific discussion, it is debt, and the debt that the IMF doles out to third world countries. And so they launch into this, and this kind of launches the whole book forward. And at one point in the sections that we're covering today, he even this is kind of a touchstone throughout the first two or three sections, a touchstone example. And he goes through and he talks about the origination of debt and the origination of money. And he critiques Adam Smith quite a lot, and he mentions that Adam Smith is sort of the founder of our modern capitalist ideal, and he's the founder of the myth of barter, which is the second section. Not really. I don't think he credits him with being the founder of that myth, but Adam Smith is the one who first really exploits that myth and uses it to project his own economic ideals upon the world. And Adam Smith is the one that thrusts us into this new age where we're no longer the line between government and economic entity, like the merchant, is blurred a lot more. So, and as part of that, and this is, I'm going to kind of jump around the whole thing because it's all very unified, but as part of that myth or that blurring of the boundaries, I really discovered, and maybe this is what I've taken away most from this first section or this first whole five sections, is there is no real difference between the state and, say, a corporation like Google, or they're more like children of the state, if you want to think about it that way. Because the whole ideal, or the whole idea of a corporation can only exist with the power of the state. A corporation is a legal entity that frees the owner of the corporation from the burden of responsibility. So, for instance, say you founded a corporation and you make widgets. And those widgets, you sell those widgets out to the public. And one day, you decide you need a loan. You need a loan because you want to make these widgets better. You want to add widgets onto the widgets and make them better. And, great idea, right? So you form this corporation, and you put the loan in the name of the corporation, not in your name. No, that would be too risky. And so you risk a whole lot, but it's not you that has to bear the risk. Say these widgets fail, and now you're not making any money, you're not making any money, and you can't repay that loan. Well, that's not your problem. You formed a corporation. The government sees that as a separate entity. And in more recent years, we even see that people like Mitt Romney call corporations people too. And so corporations can give money to politicians to get them elected. And so this entity of corporate power, it is an arm of the state, because the state protects that corporation in ways that it would never protect the individual that runs the corporation. That corporation can go under, it can cease to exist, and the person that owns it, like in the case of Sears Roebuck here in the United States, Sears went under, they went bankrupt, they are no longer in existence. Kmart was a subsidiary of it, and they are no longer in existence. But the CEO, the man running the companies, the corporations, he became infinitely more wealthy than he would have had it stayed in business. In fact, he benefited so much from the sale of assets from the corporation to Amazon and to other, to Lowe's, I believe, is another company that bought some assets from him. He benefited so much from it that, I mean, his wealth is ungodly. It's insane how much money he made. And there it is, money. He made these bits and bytes on a computer, these little pieces of paper that represent some sort of value. He made these things, and these things are also owned by the state. Now, you might say, in the U.S., these things are actually owned by the Federal Reserve. And many of my Rothbardian friends out there, they're probably chafing at the bit to mention this to me. But in fact, the Federal Reserve is also a corporation. And they are protected. They are more protected, in fact, than any other corporation, as far as I can tell. They're a corporation, which is another arm of the state. And let's extend this further, which Graeber doesn't really get into this, but this is an idea that was triggered in me whenever I was reading. Let's get into it further. What is commonly called the fourth leg of government, the media, the CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News, all of them, the New York Times, all of them, they are also all corporations. They are also all an appendage of the state. And that appendage works, although sometimes you may think that it's working against the state and they're uncovering unsavory facts about state actors, in the end, they're beholden to the state. And in the end, they're protected by the state. Or at least they're protected as far as it benefits the state. And so corporations, this is what made me realize this book just the first, I think it was the first two sections combined, made me realize that corporations are an arm of the state. And for an anarchist like myself, or like possibly my listeners, that's a problem. That's a problem because for the Rothbardians, say, for the AnCaps, that's a problem because they say we'll burn down. Oh, with these riots recently, they'll say, why are they burning down these private companies? These private companies have nothing to do with the oppression and so on. But in fact, they do. Through this example alone, they do. Through this, the fact that they are an arm of the state, they support the state, they pay in their taxes, they do everything at the leisure of the state. And so corporations are not free from guilt in this. Oh, and of course, Graeber does touch on the idea of guilt. And I know this is shifting topics, but I thought it was just fascinating that he linked something I studied. I studied linguistics a lot in college, and although it wasn't my primary focus, but one of the things that he touched on kind of warmed my heart just a little bit. Guilt, the word guilt. It in Middle or Old High German and Middle English and Old English and all these Germanic languages, then the word goes back to geld or guilt, GILT. Dutch, I think, is guilt, and it touches on it can mean something like gold or money, and so it's like a money payment or a for your guilt. For your incrimination, maybe. And so he goes into the linguistic field here to seek an origination of this word. And the word originates, the word guilt in English originates back to this very, it's connected to the idea of debt and money and the myths surrounding them. And he touches on that in his section and subsections dealing with primordial debt, which is debt that you start out life with. You're born, you're instantly in debt to your parents, you're instantly in debt to your society. And he breaks down the idea of society, deconstructs it, if you will. And he doesn't go as far as to disprove the idea of societal debt, or he doesn't really go as far as saying that there is no society or social contract, although he does lay the groundwork for that. But he does kind of poke holes in the theory with the points that he brings up about it. And everything is built. All of these constructs that we have about the economy and debt and money and corporations and society in general, all of these constructs rely on the state. And to try to imagine a world without the state, then you also have to imagine the world, this same world, without corporations, which for some that sounds great. Even for me, that sounds great, but for some it doesn't. But you also have to imagine the world without what we think of as money. Even I think in the last section that we're covering today, In Search of Myth, right at the end, he discusses, let me see. Well, let me just read it. Oops, excuse me. Let me just read it. This is a great trap of the 20th century. On one side is the logic of the market, where we like to imagine we all start out as individuals who don't owe each other anything. On the other is the logic of the state, where we all begin with a debt we can never truly pay. We are constantly told that they are opposites, and that between them they contain the only real human possibilities. But it's a false dichotomy. States created markets. Markets require states. Neither would continue without the other, at least in anything like the forms we would recognize today. And that's his, that is, I think in that paragraph he sums up what he has been building up to. States require markets. Markets that they control. They control it through debt. They control it through the very money, the very foundation of the markets. I mean, imagine a world where your life does not revolve around the dollar or the euro or whatever it is that you use. Imagine if your life simply was controlled by you, your need for food and shelter, and there's nothing out there that you, like taxes, for instance. You don't have to pay taxes, because without markets in the state, there's no one to pay taxes to. And he goes hard against that too, or on that, I shouldn't say against it, because he's been very explicit about not exactly taking a hardline stance to anything, which I think is wonderful. It's well within the tradition of anarchism. But and let's just go into that actually, because that is connected to this world without government, world without markets. He explains the origin of taxation through, multiple examples, but one that really stuck with me was his example of Athens. Back in Athens' time, they didn't tax their citizens. The only people they taxed were their enemies. They would conquer a city-state or a nation or an area, and then they would levy taxes against them. Of course, it was more, they would levy tributes from them. And in fact, that state of Athens, the city-state of Athens, they would only tax those who they considered enemies. They would tax their conquered lands. And so the idea of taxation, the whole origin of taxation, came from the idea to tax or to levy tribute from those you considered your enemy. So if you apply that to today, the taxes that, in my view, it's, or in my perception, it's all about the U.S. government, because that's where I'm at. The taxes that they levy against me, you would only tax someone from the origin or the original idea of it. You would only tax someone that you see as an enemy, and therefore they would tax the enemy of the state, the people that they see as antithetical to themselves. And individuality, which Emma Goldman and, all of the early anarchists talked about, individuality is antithetical to the state. Think of Nazi Germany. In Nazi Germany, you needed the entire citizenry to be unified against an enemy. An enemy, say, France or whoever they were conquering next. The whole society was unified. There were probably individuals, but they didn't act as individuals. In that same time period, the U.S. history books celebrate the fact that all U.S. citizens came together to fight Nazi Germany, and we acted as one. And whereas that is kind of a keystone of humanity, where we can work together and act together. If you really study the history, you really study the examples through history of how the U.S. came together, it was through the force of government. The force of government that limited resources to the citizens of the United States. And they used those, and sometimes it wasn't even to use those resources that they were limiting in the war effort. It was simply an imposition on the citizens to bring them to order, to bring them together and force them to fight an enemy. So Graeber's talk, the section, it wasn't a very large section, but his section about taxation really kind of opened my eyes to the true meaning of the idea that taxation is theft, which is a common, which is a common trope with the ANCAPs these days. But he really gets into tax, the problem of taxes. I think the best way to illustrate it is just by reading a little bit more. Let's just start here. Nowadays, we all think we know the answer to this question. Why taxes, that is. We pay our taxes so that the government can provide us with services. This starts with security services. Military protection being often about the only service some early states were really able to provide. By now, of course, the government provides all sorts of things. All of this is said to go back to some sort of original social contract that everyone somehow agreed on, though no one really knows exactly when or by whom, or why we should be bound by the decisions of distant ancestors on this one matter when we don't feel particularly bound by the decisions of our distant ancestors on anything else. All of this makes sense if you assume that markets come before governments. But the whole argument totters quickly once you realize that they don't. There is an alternative explanation, one created to be in keeping with the state credit theory approach. It's referred to as primordial debt theory, which is the title of this section, and it has been developed largely in France by a team of researchers, not only economists, but anthropologists, historians, and classicists, originally assembled around the figures of Michel Aglietta and André Olleon. I don't even know if I said that right. And more recently, Bruno Theré. It has since been taken up by neo-Keynesians in the United States and the United Kingdom as well. I won't go on with that because I think I'd have to read four or five more paragraphs just to get to it. So, but what he's talking, this is where he mentions the social contract and taxes, and this is what I was talking about. And he's kind of just questioning the whole foundational idea of taxes and the primordial debt theory. And it really struck a chord with me because I've always kind of gone along with that trope, taxation is theft, but I never really understood, I understood it on the basis of reason, because taxation, it is some guys or girls in an entity, let's call it a government, and they decide that you owe them money. You don't know why you owe them money, but they decided you owe them money. If you don't give them money, they will kill you. Maybe not immediately. They'll try to arrest you. If you resist violently, they will kill you because you're resisting violently. But in the end, they want to extract your wealth and take your money, and they do it by force. It's one of those things that it's kind of foundational to a lot of theories of anarchism. Even if they don't spell it out. Like the anarcho-syndicalists, they don't spell it out that way. The anarcho-communalists or communists, they don't spell it out that way. But in the end, reasonably, without a state, there wouldn't be taxes anyway. There may be communities where everyone contributes or, you know, something like that. But taxation is an exercise of authority by the state to extract wealth from their subjects, or as I said earlier, the enemies of the state, the people who are antithetical to the state. And that's kind of what I took from this. I know there's a lot more to take from this whole section, from the whole book, in fact, but from this section in particular, it really helped me form the concepts needed to really deepen my understanding of taxation and its causes and effects, for that matter. But, so that is, let's see, that was still part of the last section. We've kind of gone over most of the sections, most of what really touched with me on most of these sections, and I've really, really enjoyed the book so far, actually. It's, like I said before, I read it before, but I don't remember any of this, to be honest with you. I don't remember any. And maybe it's because back then I was a full-fledged statist. I don't know what kind of statist, but I bought into the whole idea that the government exists, the government has always existed, and it had a right to exist. But of course now I don't really believe in anything that claims existence through force and threat of death. And that's exactly the entire claim of the government. Oh wait, there was one other thing, actually, before I start wrapping things up. It's just in the beginning of In Search of Myth. I had no idea, and I think this is wonderful. I'm just gonna read it because me trying to paraphrase it won't give you the full understanding. It's about the Wizard of Oz, the wonderful Wizard of Oz, in fact. So let's see where to start. Oh, I'll just start at the beginning. Credit theorists have long been hobbled by the lack of an equally compelling narrative. This is not to say that all sides in the currency debates that ranged between 1850 and 1950 were not in the habit of deploying mythological weaponry. This was true particularly, perhaps, in the United States. In 1894, the Greenbackers, who pushed for detaching the dollar from gold entirely to allow the government to spend freely on job creation campaigns, invented the idea of the March on Washington, an idea that was to have endless resonance in U.S. history. L. Frank Baum's book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which appeared in 1900, is widely recognized to be a parable for the populist campaign of William Jennings Bryan, who twice ran for president on the free silver platform, vowing to replace the gold standard with a bimetallic system that would allow the free creation of silver money alongside gold. As with the Greenbackers, one of the main constituencies for the movement was debtors, particularly Midwestern farm families such as Dorothy's, who had been facing a massive wave of foreclosures during the severe recession of the 1890s. According to the populist reading, the Wicked Witches of the East and West represented the East and West Coast bankers, promoters of the benefactors from the tight money supply. The Scarecrow represented the farmers, who didn't have the brains to avoid the debt trap. The Tin Woodsman was the industrial proletariat, who didn't have the heart to act in solidarity with the farmers. The Cowardly Lion represents the political class who didn't have the courage to intervene. The Yellow Brick Road, Silver Slippers, Emerald City, and Hapless Wizard presumably speak for themselves. Oz, of course, is the standard abbreviation for ounce. As an attempt to create a new myth, Baum's story was remarkably effective. As political propaganda, less so. William Jennings Bryan failed in three attempts to win the presidency. The silver standard was never adopted, and few nowadays even remember what The Wonderful Wizard of Oz was originally supposed to be about. I thought that was brilliant. I had no idea. And I claim to have read this book, and you would think that, of all things, would have stuck with me, but it didn't. I had no idea, and it makes so much sense, and so much in kind of popular culture is celebrated about this wonderful Wizard of Oz story, and I doubt that anyone knows anything about the origins of it, which I just have to say, I think it was wonderful. And it kind of shows how far people are willing to go to get what they want put into effect for greater society. Because this would have affected all of society. Maybe for the better, and maybe for the worse, but either way, the worship of the state, or the idea of using the state for your own benefits, is kind of what we anarchists are all against. We're against using the state to benefit, well, we're against using the state's power, the destructive, forceful power of the state to benefit a few, because as history has proven, the state always benefits the few rather than the many. There have been some cases where it did benefit the many. Very few cases, however. It's more likely to benefit the few. And in today's world, we see just who it benefits. It's the likes of Google, the likes of Amazon, it's the likes of all of the big all of the big capitalists that we can think of. And it's not just the capitalists, because the capitalists, they are a child of the greater government, and it eventually benefits the greater government, the Senate, the House, the President, all of their connections, and it's a top-down system of power, where we at the bottom, the wage slaves, the tax cows, we don't have the power that they say we have. They say go out and vote. They say go out and demonstrate. And maybe that will eventually come to something, but in my experience, I seriously doubt it. I doubt voting is going to change anything. I don't vote. I don't want to participate in a system like this. I can vote 100 times and it never do anything, because the majority, well, even say in a presidential election, it doesn't matter. If you vote with the majority, your guy or gal still may not get chosen for the presidency, because the people's vote doesn't even matter. Maybe you can vote in local things, but why waste your energy? Why not work harder on your own individual community, you and your community? And you can devote so much more effort to that than wasting your time voting and participating in the great scam that government is. And that's really the thing. That's what this whole book, it's an in-depth outline, so to speak, of anarchism, I think. Or at least it will help spur on thoughts of anarchy and the anarchist ideals, and it'll help you understand the markets, or the idea of the markets, and how the markets and the marketplace are all the creation of the government, and therefore are all controlled by said government. And I'm not a fan, to be honest with you. That's why, like, the agorist position of participating in black and gray markets, it really appeals to me. And because it's not a constructed market with corporations, it's person to person, working together, working within your community. And whenever you really get down to it, because that's what I do, a lot of my purchases and a lot of my, all of my different, what would you call it, economic activity, a lot of it, not all of it, I wish it could be all of it, but a lot of it is from me to my neighbor, or from my neighbor to me, and I realize the need for exact amounts of value exchange, it lessens. You don't need, say, for instance, I bought a mask for one of my neighbors recently. And he saw mine, he thought it was neat. It's for the whole COVID thing. I bought a mask, and he thought it was really cool, and I said, yeah, I'll get you one. And how much? And it's like one of those things where, sure, I would like to be repaid value for value, but he really wants something like this, and I'm willing to just give it to him, because it doesn't take away from me involuntarily. Such as how taxes do, or how the whole concept of the US dollar does, and its failing value, and so on and so forth. And so you find that, that's another thing. He talks a lot about these kind of voluntary transactions between tribes or people, individuals, and the kind of rituals around it, and how it's never counting out pennies to make sure the value exchange is exact. It's never about that. And that's how it is. That's a natural market. But maybe we wouldn't call it a market, because, as he says, I don't know. We'll have to read and find out, because we'll see what he calls it. Because as he says, markets are a creation of the government. So I think that's going to be it for what we covered today. These are just my thoughts. I'm not trying to make an attempt to outline each section of every book that I read, or that we read, I should say. What I'm trying to do is to just touch on the things that really interested me in this whole, 'cause it's not a book review specifically. It's a book club. We talk about what's fun. And you guys can talk to me. You can head over to the About page on anarchobook.club and find out how to contact me. You can email me. I do better with, like, if it's going to be a long discussion, email is probably better. But if you just want to say something real quick to me, you can find me on Mastodon. And it's real easy. I mean, you know, it's just, so just, you can find me on those. Talk to me about what you think after you've read this, or even before, just what you think about this episode in general. And maybe we can start a discussion, and maybe you've read this and you have something that it reminded you of, or you've read something into it that I didn't mention, and we can have a talk about that. And maybe if it's something that really grabs me, I might even say it on the next episode, talk about it on the next episode. So that's all I've got for this first part of the book. Next time, we will be covering, let's see, down the list, we have a brief treatise on the moral grounds of economic relations, games with sex and debt, honor and degradation, or on the foundations of contemporary civilization, credit versus bullion, and the cycles of history, the Axial Age, 800 BC to 600 AD, the Middle Ages, 600 to 450 AD. Okay. Then the Age of the Great Capitalist Empires, 450 to 1971 AD. And then 1971 to the beginning of something yet to be determined. So that's what we're going to cover. I strongly encourage anyone listening to this to pick up a copy of this book. It is on the website. So you can go to anarchobook.club and find it in the library section. And I'm currently working on the library section. I want to make it, instead of one big page with all these books that are disorganized, I'm going to sort all the books by author and just have on the library section the author, and each author will have their own page. Right now I've only got Emma Goldman finished, but I've got her on her own page. And I will be working on the rest. If you have any ideas or any requests for the website, just give me a shout out on Mastodon or send me an email. And I think that's going to be it for this episode. So I hope you guys enjoyed this. And again, I can't say it enough. Tell me if you did. Find me on Mastodon. Shoot me an email. And I will see you guys next time. But that is it. Thanks, guys. Bye.